and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The government of New Zealand has announced a range of tobacco control measures in a bid to eventually phase out smoking. This includes banning the sale of cigarettes and tobacco to anyone born after 2008. The legislation will mean that people currently the age of 14 and under, once in adulthood, will never be able to purchase legally tobacco for their entire lifetime. Is this prohibition a step too far? Let's ask Dr. Helmi Hajar-Maidin. He's a consultant respiratory physician at Pantai Hospital KL. Helmi, Malaysia might be planning a generational endgame to smoking similar to New Zealand's recent move. I'm just wondering how you would respond to those who see this as perhaps excessive state interference, and they say that, you know, it's for the state to perhaps regulate for safety and to minimize harm, but it's not for the state to tell people how to live their lives.
I think any public health intervention is going to involve some degree of restrictions. So, for example, restrictions of movement, certain types of behavior that may not be allowed. The question is always going to be, where do we draw that line? Who decides where that line is? And, of course, what or why is that line there in the first place? Now, for me, tobacco is a slightly different, it's a slightly unique product. It's unlike any other product that's out there. And it's something that you're not going to be able to get off the shelf. If you think about it, tobacco, you know, cigarettes, they are addictive after just a few puffs. And, you know, that's why tobacco companies, you know, it's well documented in their internal memos that, you know, they push for young people, for youth to pick it up because it becomes a lifelong addiction and you have a lifelong customer. It kills 50% of all users. It costs billions to governments across the world in terms of lost productivity and healthcare costs. But it provides profit to a very select few companies. So if you imagine we had such a product that was introduced today, you know, one that kills, one that's addictive, you're never going to allow it to be on the shelf. And that, to me, is a very important factor to take into consideration when you're deciding or you're debating whether it is excessive use of state intervention, because not all products are the same. So I agree in general terms that we should be very careful when we do use such measures where the government or the state intervenes. But once again, to me, tobacco is very different from any other product that's out there.
Helmi, you know, I see a lot of people on social media persuaded by the argument. The generational ban seems simple, but it does move society from persuasion into policing, enforcement, and punishment as an approach. Have you lost faith in public education and now favor more authoritarian method to deal with the problem of smoking?
I wouldn't say that we've lost faith or I've lost faith in education. Education remains the cornerstone. It'll always remain the cornerstone of any public health intervention. It's just that you are needing to use various different measures to decrease the prevalence of smoking. Now, at this point in time, about 1 in 5 people smoke in Malaysia. And the goal, the tobacco endgame, has always been to bring that down to about 5% by 2040. And there are various mechanisms in which you can utilize in order to bring this down. There's something called MPower, which was introduced by the WHO in 2008. So M stands for monitoring tobacco use. P is to protect people from smoking. So things like banning smoking in public areas. O is to offer help to quit. So you offer the various methods in which you can help people quit smoking. W is to warn about the dangers of smoking. So you see things on boxes, for example, where you can tell or advise or warn people about the different health consequences of smoking. E is to enforce bans, and this is on advertising and promotion. And last but not least, we've got R, which is raise taxes on tobacco. And these are all very evidence-based methods that have been proven worldwide to bring down the use of tobacco or smoking across the globe. But you can't
right,
just...
Right, but help me, can
one.
We... Sorry, yeah, Mike, tell me, can I... But the point, the difference is, in this generational ban, the idea, the concept is not to reduce, not to mitigate, but in fact to eliminate. So it's a zero number of smokers at some point in the future is the end goal. It's very different from what you're saying. And it's going to require a very different type of setup in order to sustain, isn't it?
I know, I would disagree with you. I don't think it's different at all. We are wanting to gradually bring down the prevalence, and there are various ways to do that. You can help smokers quit. You can stop people from smoking in the first place. There's no real logical argument why we should promote and allow people to become nicotine addicts for the rest of their lives. What I'm saying is it's a very complex system, and as with any complex problem, there isn't going to be one methodology or one method in which you'll be able to bring things down. So banning a particular generation from ever smoking, which is going to happen in the future, so bear in mind, this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. If and when it is introduced in our Tobacco Act, it's going to happen many years down the line. There'll be plenty of time to prepare for these things. So it's not like a draconian measure that's going to be introduced just tomorrow and as a consequence it's going to be punitive. No, we're going to prepare people for this future. We're going to ensure that the other mechanisms are in place, particularly helping those who are currently smokers to quit. But in the future, we don't want people to end up doing things or pushing themselves or being tricked by the tobacco industry into becoming lifelong addicts.
Help me, I have a medical-related question. You mentioned that smoking kills 50% of users, tobacco kills 50% of users. How do we determine that the user, how many Malaysians have died of smoking-related causes every year?
If we look at that particular figure that I mentioned, it's meant to be something that has come from epidemiological studies globally. Now, in Malaysia, you're not just talking about the number of people who are dying, because sometimes we focus on the absolute numbers, but we forget about the morbidity, so the consequences where you fall sick. So one example is there was a study looking at three things. If I'm not mistaken, it was emphysema, lung cancer, and heart disease, three very common diseases that are usually driven by the excessive or even the moderate use of smoking. And these cost the government about 3 billion ringgit. And this was going back about 10 years ago. Now, you can imagine the numbers in terms of how it escalates over time, how the various other comorbidities, right? We're talking about other forms of cancer, even bladder cancer, for example, all the costs involved when it comes to treating these things, tapering it down, making sure it's under control. Now, if you talk about deaths, we're talking about upwards of 20,000 annually in Malaysia, and these are with regard to diseases linked to smoking.
Helmy, I know you kind of suggest that tobacco might be, unique, but I wonder if you look at the issue of addiction, it's partly the consequence of the substance. You say tobacco is highly addictive, but there are a lot of substances that have become addicted just through cultural use because there is, a push, a marketing push to make them, part of our lifestyle. Say, for instance, sugar and salt and oily foods. These are very much part of the reasons why Malaysians are so unhealthy. Is there a slippery slope here? Once you allow for tobacco to be regulated in this way, couldn't we see, at least in public policy terms, a greater intervention in all kinds of other substances that affect public health on an aggregate level?
I think you should argue and debate and decide each product on individual merits or individual issues. Now, once again, I wouldn't say classify nicotine in the same way I would classify sugar. Sugar is not nowhere near as addictive. If you take it in moderate amounts, it's actually necessary for you to remain alive. Whereas nicotine or cigarettes, even a single stick is going to be harmful. So you're not quite equating carrots with, or rather apples with oranges here. Now, I would argue that anything that is involving some form of state intervention will need to be debated as we are right now. And we need to look at things in context. So I wouldn't say that it's a slippery slope because there isn't, once again, any other thing that is out there that is very similar to tobacco. We wouldn't be having this debate if, let's say, we were talking about crack cocaine, for example, right? Something that's extremely addictive, something that is very destructive to society in many ways. And arguably, you could say that, if we don't want the state to intervene, we should allow everyone to just go ahead and take whatever they want. But I don't think that's something that we would be wanting to push forward.
Would this, looking at perhaps the generational, the smoking endgame, would that include vape and e-cigarettes? I'm just wondering what the thinking about vape and e-cigarettes should be in terms of public health strategies.
So I would argue that it should be included. Whether or not it is will depend on what is actually on or in the Tobacco Act once it's released for public scrutiny. The evidence at this point in time does not show any strengths in terms of vaping or e-cigarettes being a proper or medically proven way of decreasing the use of cigarettes. So it's not really a quit smoking method that's been proven medically to work. In terms of the regulatory issues, I think that when we do have the Tobacco Act, we should ensure that these things, the e-cigarettes or vape, as you will, are also restricted in a similar fashion to conventional cigarettes. So in terms of promotional or advertising as well, these are things that at this point in time are not very well controlled. And you can see all kinds of advertisements going around promoting the use of these nicotine products. And this is where I think having the Act will be quite helpful, because it can help us restrict things and once again protect the health of our nation.
Helmy, I'm sorry to drag you back to your crack cocaine analogy, but if tobacco is as dangerous as crack cocaine, why not ban it outright? I mean, the generational endgame strategy envisages a time when there's a certain class of people who are not able to buy tobacco to protect them, and then an older folk who are allowed to take this highly addictive substance. I mean, if it's that bad, shouldn't it be banned outright, like crack cocaine?
Well, it should, but we are living in a world where, you know, there are lots of legacy issues. We are dealing with an industry that's worth billions, that is, you know, part of most portfolios in terms of funds. So it's not that straightforward. We are talking about something that's been around for a few centuries. So once again, if this was a new product that was introduced today for sale in your mom and pop shop, no one in their right mind is going to say, yay, let's take this thing that's going to kill us and, you know, make us sick, even though it may taste, you know, for whatever brief moment to give you a bit of a high. So yes, in an ideal world, we will want to be able to stop everything and ban everything today. But we take into account the fact that, one, the life is not as straightforward as that. Secondly, it is once again an addictive substance. So it's not just about stopping people from starting. But for me, the important thing that's sometimes missing from the conversation is how to help more and more people to quit. Because 50% of all smokers do want to quit. It's usually a combination of physiological but also social issues, economic issues that drive people to continue smoking. So it's a very complex system, which is not going to be determined or solved by just one intervention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Helmy. That was Dr. Helmy Hajamaydin, consultant respiratory physician at Pantai Hospital KL. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to consider this. We'll be back with more. Thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Health Minister Kari Jamaluddin said he will table a new Tobacco and Smoking Control Act in the upcoming Parliament meeting to update the current tobacco control legislation. This new law will include what Kari has described as a generational endgame for smoking in the country. Joining us on the show now, we have Azrul Mohamed Khalid, the Chief Executive of the Gallen Centre for Health and Social Policy. Azrul, looking at New Zealand, they're going to be banning the sale of tobacco for its next generation, all part of this sweeping crackdown on smoking. They aim to eventually phase out the habit in the country. I'm just wondering whether you think that this is a decision that should be placed in the hands of governments. And if so, should Malaysia be looking to do the same?
Well, you know, this is definitely state interference on individual behaviour. Yes, it will curtail the liberties of smokers, especially those who are on the cusp of adulthood, eager to get their first legal puff of a cigarette without getting caned, ears twisted or forced to clean school toilets. But the fact is that the number of young people who are taking up smoking is on the rise in Malaysia, defying a downward trend in developed countries. So whether or not Malaysia can get this done, we need to compare where Malaysia is today compared to New Zealand. The adult smoking prevalence in NZ is at around 13.4%, while Malaysia is at 21.3%. Singapore, which is also considering the same strategy, is around 10%. But by doing this, Malaysia has the potential to make an unprecedented, massive, positive leap in tobacco control, drastically locking the gate against new smokers. And it will bring those numbers down. But you know what? The challenges are also formidable. It's an uphill climb, even for those countries. But for Malaysia, it will be particularly steep. The 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey found that the highest prevalence of current smokers was among men of 30 to 34 years of age, which was around 49%. And for those slightly older, it was 48%. More than 40% of men and 1.2% of women in this country smoke. So what this tells me is that enforcement will need to be stronger and more effective than ever before to beat back against the illicit market, which will emerge. Unfortunately, based on our track record, it is also a weak spot.
So, Azro, what you're saying is that, taking your description of ear-twisting and toilet washing, this is going to be the permanent condition for a segment of Malaysian society. They'll never reach the cusp of, as it were, adulthood in their minds, which allows them to smoke. Now, is this the way we should design social policy? Because, as you say, while Malaysia is very weak at enforcement, there will be enforcement. How the double standards, the loopholes, the possibilities for corruption and petty corruption, right? Just find some kid smoking, well, now not a kid, maybe he's 35, and you can get some sort of inducement so that he's not locked up. I mean, all the downsides that we have of social policies based on these authoritarian assumptions, do you think that there is a better way?
Well, you know, Sharad, I can only look at the science, I can only look at the evidence and what the data tells me, and also I have the privilege of looking at it strictly from a public health perspective. And when you look at the public health data, is that lung cancer now makes up one of the top three cancers diagnosed in Malaysia. Only 11% of those diagnosed with lung cancer survive past their fifth year of diagnosis. And a third of non-smokers reported being exposed to secondhand smoke both at home and at the office. So, honestly, something needs to be done, even though we don't have that great a track record when it comes to interventions that are relating to tobacco. You know, will there be unintended consequences? Absolutely. You know, the consequences will involve the potential for smokers to transition to become non-smokers and be cured of their nicotine addiction and for them to live longer. And in this case, it's going to be through state intervention.
I'm thinking about the unintended consequences of what happened in the prohibition period in the US, where, you know, a thriving black market for alcohol happened. That could be one of the, you know, unintended consequences of this. But I'm just wondering, when you think about a smoking ban and attitudes towards smoking, and this comes in a period of a pandemic, I'm just wondering whether that shifts the needle, the conversation in any way, whether we're now much more open to taking a hard stand on smoking and use of tobacco products. Especially if you look around the world, you see governments taking a hard stand on vaccination, on mandatory vaccination, for instance. Has the attitudes towards regulating tobacco and smoking shifted during the pandemic?
Well, you know, Lisa, one thing we will have to deal with, one of the unintended consequences being the emergence of a very large black market. And this is something that's going to definitely be a problem. And this is something that the government needs to be able to address. It will emerge. The second is your point just now about whether people are much more amenable to having the state intervene when it comes to issues of public health. And I think we've seen this during the COVID crisis. But, you know, I think when we look at it really, we have to ask the question whether the existing strategies concerning smoking cessation, especially when it's been driven by the state, whether it's been successful, or, you know, what has it worked, having so much investment put into place and so many interventions. And the reality here is this, and I'll share with both of you, you know, in the past 5 years, we've only managed to drop around 1.5% in terms of smoking prevalence. So success in smoking cessation has not been that great or rapid. Quitting is hard. It takes smokers at least 30 attempts and relapse rates are high. Eliminating cigarettes is only the first step to total freedom from tobacco and nicotine. So what has worked are easy and hassle-free access to proven and evidence-driven interventions, such as nicotine replacement therapies, you know, like nicotine gum, patches which involve the slow delivery of nicotine while reducing cravings and the severity of tobacco withdrawal symptoms. And the reality is that we need state intervention to be able to make these NRTs, which work, easily available over the counter so that smokers who want to quit can easily get them without needing a prescription or needing to see a pharmacist. You know, just get them like you're buying Panadol or Minyak Cakapa or Tiger Balm at the checkout counter. But at the end of the day, you know, it's really going back to the individual, and we need to be able to support smokers who want to quit.
Okay, but what I wanted to ask you why, you know, and you explained some of the reasons why people can't quit, but why do people start, Azrul? And is there something missing in the many of the campaigns that we have when they think about how to prevent kids from starting this habit at all, or even if they're in their adulthood? And that might be pleasure. There is something deeply pleasurable, and I'm not a smoker, but there's something deeply pleasurable about smoking and many of the habits, personal habits that we have, and we are connected to them for all kinds of reasons. So, you know, in wanting to use the state to decouple it, we're in some ways causing harm to people or not recognizing that there is this level or dimension of personal life. Is this, have I completely misunderstood why, you know, why these campaigns plateau? They don't seem to be able to get at a core group of people who want this particular form of pleasure.
Well, you know, Sharad, every smoker that I've spoken to has indicated their own reasons as to why they started smoking. I'm not a smoker myself, just like you and Melissa. And the thing is that they have their own reasons why they started, whether it's because of peer pressure or being influenced by the media and so forth. But what we can do is help them to quit, especially those who are dedicated and wanting to quit smoking. And this is something that we can do today. And with what we have in resources that we have available today, we should be able to help such individuals, because it is addiction. This problem that we're talking about this evening is part of addiction medicine. What we're talking about is addiction to nicotine. And we should be able to do that and not make it much more easily available. And one of the ways that we can actually help with this addiction is to sort of reduce or cut off that supply of nicotine. In the case we're talking about here is in terms of cigarettes. So
well,
it should
Azrul,
be able
about,
to be
state. What about vape and e-cigarettes, Azrul? Do you think that that should be included as part of a smoking cessation strategy?
Well, you know, make no mistake, vape and e-cigarettes are actually the next evolution in nicotine addiction. Vapers will find that though they may have stopped smoking cigarettes, their addiction has actually transferred to e-cigarettes and vape. Some, Melissa, will be actually dual users. I'm sure you know of people like that who smoke both tobacco and e-cigarettes. You know, a study amongst 1,300 university students from six universities in Malaysia found that 75% actually smoked e-cigarettes or vape, but that 40% did both. Disposable vape devices with 200 puffs, which have 3 to 5% nicotine levels, such as the one that I have here in my hand, are already available today for 20 ringgit, and secondary students have already been seen puffing on them. And the reality here is this. Quit smoking clinics are now reporting that they're not only seeing people who are trying to quit smoking cigarettes, but now include people who are trying to quit vaping. Smokers find quitting vaping as difficult as when they stop smoking. The NRTs, which I mentioned earlier, are being used to help both to quit because they work. So public health strategies now must actually include vape and e-cigarettes, not as a way of smoking cessation, but as part of the problem in addressing nicotine addiction. So my fear here is this, that if vaping becomes entrenched amongst the younger population, it will actually undo all the progress we made on curbing smoking.
Okay, so we curb smoking, then we curb vaping, and the addiction train carries on to something else. Is there a problem in understanding how human beings operate, Azrul? Are we, in fact, in some ways hardwired to some form of addiction, you know, and we'll move on to something like sugar and sitting in front of our televisions for an inordinate amount of time or not sleeping enough? When does it stop? When do we recognize that, you know, the state can't be the nanny, or should it? I mean, what do you think?
You know, I would normally agree with you. And the fact is sugar, for example, is an addiction. Watching TV, watching Netflix, being online all the time could be addiction as well. But the fact is that when it comes to this particular addiction, it's not only just about individual behavior or self-harm here. We're also talking about the possibility of others around you also being harmed by secondhand smoke, you know, and also by the fact that I mentioned just now, you know, only 11% of those diagnosed with lung cancer survive past their fifth year of diagnosis. So, you know, I would want to see more people live and be able to be with their loved ones and family. And in this case, what I would like to see is that the government not so much act as sort of a nanny state, but more of reaching out their hand and allowing them to, you know, be of assistance in doing something about this form of addiction. I think this generational ban could be a very interesting experiment that Malaysia will be part of those countries that are deciding to do it. And we'll see whether it's successful, because at the end of the day, if you really wanted to get something illegal, you will get it anyway, even if the government or any other law actually prohibits you from getting that.
Azra, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Azra Muhammad Khalid from the Galen Centre, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching. Good night.